Welcome back to the Unbreakable Mindset Podcast with me, Jude Daunt. I hope you are all well and had a gorgeous week. We have had amazing sunshine here in the UK, which has just been an absolute joy. But then on the flip side of it, it's one of those things that when you get sun in the UK, if you want to do something indoors, you almost feel like, no, I should be outside. I should be enjoying that sun. And it's like that fear of missing out on the sun. And then we'll get sick of it. And then when the rain comes, which it did yesterday, we're all like, oh, thank God it rained. But like, you wouldn't do that on holiday. You'd be like so sad if it actually rained when you were on holiday, because your expectation is that it's really sunny every day that you're on holiday. So we're a weird little bunch in the UK, aren't we? Anyway, what a weird old week I had. I was back to back with clients all week, which was lush, but I had horrific toothache. And when I went to the spa with my friend, the Rudden Park one that I told you about, honest to God, I was up till about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning, just with this crazy, crazy toothache. Like, I was taking paracetamol and ibuprofen every 2 hours, which, like, and I don't mean like as in like there was a gap. It was like I had ibuprofen and paracetamol at 9 o'clock and I couldn't cope with the pain. So I just double dosed again at 11 o'clock. And then again at 1 o'clock, I was like chewing paracetamol and rubbing it on my gums because it was just so horrific. I've never had pain like it. I honestly think that was worse than childbirth. That was just, oh God, look, if anyone's listening and they've got toothache, my heart goes out to you because that was horrific. So I made an emergency appointment the next day and managed to get in for a tooth extraction on the Wednesday, which, can I say, nobody looks forward to the dentist. But I had a tooth extraction when I was early 20s and I was very naive, I would say. I went on my own and they'd said, oh, you probably need like either a root canal filling or we can take it out. And they were very casual about it. We can just take it out. I was 22. Luckily, it's at the back. You can't see. But I was so naive. I honestly thought that tooth would grow back if it got taken out. And I was just like, take it out. It's fine. Just take it out. And it, because it was one of the back ones and it's really embedded in, like them ones are chunky ones, I remember being in so much pain and feeling like I'd been attacked at the end of that because he had his knee on my chest and was trying to yank it out. It was awful. So this tooth, I've known it's needed to come out for about 6 months and I put it off because I was just saying, I'm not ready. Like, I'll tell you when I'm ready. So I had to do a lot of like mental preparation for this. And a lot of breathing exercises when I went in and I let the dentist know that I wasn't in the right headspace for it, like I'm not good. And when I'd booked it in previously, I had booked in for the dentist that I feel the most comfortable with, like I'd specified the dentist that I wanted, but because I'd made this emergency appointment where I was with a dentist that I didn't know, anyway, he struggled to get it out and then had to call on the dentist that I'd originally wanted, so feel like I manifested that a little bit and it was fine. Do you know what? It was absolutely fine. These guys are amazing. They know what they're doing. It wasn't like that horrific experience 20 years ago. So, and the pain, like the pain of getting the tooth out and afterwards was way less than what it was when it was there. So we are out and I feel much better now. And the podcast episode that you're going to hear, I recorded it the day before I got the tooth out. So I was working through the pain on the recorded episode. And what else? Oh, the other thing that happened this was my daughter's last week at school, which is just nuts. So this feels really nice going into this week, not having to go, are you revising? What are you revising? What exams have you got tomorrow? Are you on your phone? Get off your phone. What are you revising? Are you revising? How much time are you spending on revision? So I can act, both of us can actually just breathe now and just going to college in September. So congratulations to any other parent listening who has got another child through school, because that feels like a huge achievement in itself just to get through that secondary school stage. And I don't have to worry about it for another 5 years until the little one starts secondary school. So yeah, I feel like a bit of parenting's done. Pat myself on the back for that. So enough about me. I'm going to hand over to the podcast that I recorded last week with an amazing guest. I have podcaster, comedian, Ellie Gibson from the Scummy Mummies. Enjoy. So, Ellie, you are, I'm going to tell you what you are, by the way. You are an award-winning journalist, presenter, podcaster, although that doesn't have it on your management page. Doesn't have that you're a podcaster in that
doesn't
title.
It? Yeah, right, that's it. They're fired.
And stand-up comedian, and you were born and raised in Southeast London, and you live with your husband Pete and two boys. How old are the boys now?
One's 8 and one is 12 in a week. Yeah.
Right. So you're heading into the nice teenage. Yes, that's pleasant.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Tell me, how would you describe yourself? Because you do loads. Like, even looking into more about what you do, I didn't realize how much you do in terms of, there isn't just Ellie the podcaster, how I know you in terms of. So Ellie's podcast, sorry for anyone listening, is the Scummy Mummy podcast.
Yeah,
say that right. Why did I struggle with that?
Scummy Mummies. I don't know. Maybe it's because you're so unscummy, Jude, that you have an inherent. You can't even say the word because you're so nice in your white T-shirt. Look, there's no brown stains on there.
I bet there's a makeup mark on it. I tell you. How would you describe yourself now? Because your career is very different in certain areas, isn't it?
Yeah, so I was a video games journalist for a long time, and then for over a decade, and then I met Helen. I had babies, and I met Helen, and I started doing stand-up, and then Helen and I formed this comedy double act, and then we started doing the podcast, and then that was 10 years ago. We do a live show all over the country. So, I'm a comedian. That's what I spend most of my time, most of my income comes from doing our comedy show, but I also, we do the Scummy podcast. I also do a podcast called Sort Your Shit Out, which is about sort of mental well-being and balance. The first series is about alcohol, and we're just planning the second series now. So we do that. I go on the radio sometimes, still write about games, and I stream on Twitch once or twice a week. So I am a multimedia node, Jude. I do a lot of things.
Wow. So my presumption was you started in comedy, but you didn't.
No, I started in games, yeah. I started out writing the manuals for video games, and then I became a journalist, and that was what I did for a long time, basically, until I had kids, yeah.
So a typical week then, what does a typical week look like for Ellie?
I would say there's no structure. There is structure. So a typical week, on Mondays, I do a bar fitness class, which I like very much. I had a very embarrassing time this week. Because I was doing it yesterday, and you know, it's all like Swan Lake Arms and it's all very beautiful. And then in the middle, the lady was like, oh, go and get the mats. We'll do some floor work. And as I reached up to get my mat, another girl in the class said to me, she said, has someone been drawing on your arm? And I'd forgotten that my son had asked if he could draw a tattoo on my arm when I'd had some wine with lunch on Sunday. And I'd gone, yeah, fine. And like all 12-year-old boys, he drew a penis. So I'd gone to this lovely, elegant ballet class with a penis drawn on my bicep. So that was, so now I say that's what I do on a Monday. Perhaps I can never go back, Jude, now. That's too embarrassing. But Monday I do, like, I go to the gym, and usually that's the day when I edit out, because I edit all our episodes of Scummy Mummy. So usually that's my sort of work and admin day. And then Tuesday, Wednesday is usually recording podcasts. And then Helen and I, if it's term time, we do a show in the evening. So usually we work Wednesdays, Thursdays, maybe Fridays, occasionally Saturdays. We'll do shows. We try not to work weekends because we like to have the weekends for family time.
Oh, nice.
So we actually try not to do too many Saturday nights or whatever, or even Fridays, because often if we have to travel, we have to come back on a Saturday morning. So that's sort of what it is. But that can vary wildly. If it's the summer, if it's the school holidays, then I have to do more childcare and less work, basically, and less shows. And so that's one of the things I like about my life now, is I sort of, you know, I don't really have a boss. I have a partner, but I have a partner who's in the same situation as me. So she understands the pressures of kids and work. And it's nice that we can manage our own time like that.
So how much TV work do you do? When does that get scheduled in?
Not a lot at the moment. I did a TV show a few years ago called Dar O'Brien's Go 8-Bit, but that was a while back. Occasionally I get asked to go and be a guest on things, Radio 4 and stuff like that. So I go, you know, I just sort of just schedule it around the shows, and that's how that works.
But for the most part, it sounds like you've got a really good schedule, a good routine going on in terms of how you've managed that.
I think so. I think I feel very lucky, because I know a lot of people don't have that, but I can, you know, of course there's things I have to do and appointments and meetings and stuff, but I can sort of please myself. And I'm 45 now, and I've got better at going, at sort of setting boundaries just for myself, not other people necessarily, but going, no, on Monday, actually, it's really good to try and keep that time clear to edit the podcast. So it doesn't get to, you know, the Tuesday it's supposed to go out, and I'm like, oh, I haven't done it and I haven't got time because I did that other thing. So I try to block out time for that stuff, and I've found that that's, you know, but having said all that, I still get really overwhelmed, because the thing of when you don't have a boss is, of course, you're only accountable to yourself, and you've got no one else telling you when you have to do stuff and when you have to get stuff done by necessarily. So it's, I do feel a lot of the time like there's this list that never ends, and I'm trying to get better at accepting that, accepting that that's how that is.
It's funny when you said you work on the podcast on a Monday. So I structure my week so I don't have any clients on a Monday, and I just work on the business on a Monday, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'll tell you what, the last few months, then bank holidays, that threw a curveball. I was like, fuck, chase my tail all through the week, because that Monday got taken away from us like four times or something in the last 2 months.
Yeah, it's a nightmare. I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, when you feel you've got that structure and system, and then suddenly it goes skew if, that's when it can be problematic, can't it?
So within that week, then what's the stuff that lights you up? What's the thing that you look forward to the most?
Thing I look forward to the most. I mean, I do. I like various bits of it. I like. I love being on tour with Helen. Because it's, to be honest, it's like having a little mini break with your best mate. And we always have a roadie, so either my dad or a friend Steve or Helen's brother John. And I really like all of those people as well. So it's really nice to have a night or two a week where we go, and we often just stay in a Premier Inn or whatever. It's not like we're going to Malaga, but we go and we do our show. We go for a curry afterwards, usually. Get to stay in a hotel, which means you get to have a lie-in, or again, you get to get up and have time to yourself without having to do the school run. So I do quite a lot of work in hotels. And so that's really jolly. I really like that. But I really look forward to the weekends. I really look forward to family time. And even if that's just, you know, sitting on the sofa, I just like being at home.
So is there anything in your week or still now in your career, if we make it that, you know, it's not a typical week sometimes, is there anything that you mentally have to gear yourself up for?
I mean, yeah, to be totally honest, so we tour a lot, right? I think we're doing 50 shows this year or something. And I love doing the show and it's great. But I'd be lying if I said there weren't days where I'm like, oh, it's like Wednesday afternoon and I've got all this other work to do, or I've got something going on with the family, or that the kids need sorting out. And, you know, it's raining and we've got to go and get in the van and drive for 3 or 4 hours to this room full of people who are usually drunk. And I've got to put on a very smelly cat suit. And especially if it's in the winter, it's cold and dark. And I'd be lying. Of course, I have days where I've gone, oh, I don't really feel like doing that. Yeah. But without exception, once you do get out there and you get on the stage, you have a brilliant time, because the audience lifts you up and you feel their energy, and you're like, well, you know, sometimes we have to have a conversation with ourselves or with each other. All these people have paid to be here and they want a good night. They're here to have a good time. And so you've got to, you know, sometimes you have to dig deep, but you've got to bring your energy and put it out there, because it's not fair otherwise. And always you come off stage feeling brilliant. You know, I've gone on stage with colds and flus and knee problems and, you know, general malaise and or problems at home, and you always come off stage. It's like going to the gym. You don't always want to do it, but you always feel better after.
So, because that got us thinking, to be fair, so tomorrow I'm meant to be booked in to do a live podcast to a group of call center managers and things like that. And luckily I'm doing it with a business partner. I say luckily I'm not doing it now, because I have horrific toothache. I'm piled up on drugs at the minute.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it's got to get, no, it's fine.
it's fine at the minute because I'm on drugs. So tomorrow it's getting taken out. So I had to book that in, and it was the earliest appointment I could get. And I had to ring my business partner and I was like, I'm not doing that live thing. I can't. I hadn't slept for 2 days. Like, I was literally chewing paracetamol and rubbing it on my gum because I couldn't get rid of the pain. And I was like, I need you to do it on your own. And she was like, fine, I'll put my big girl pants on. I'll do this. So I was able to get out of there. That's not the same for you. That would be really weird if Helen turned up on her own. I'm sorry. Yeah. Ellie's got toothache.
Yeah, it's not really a viable option for us. But having said that, you know, it's like our show is 2 hours long. Do you know what I mean? My mum, as she likes to remind me, was a teacher. And again, she couldn't just not go in because she didn't feel like it. And she would have to go and stand up there for 6-8 hours in front, in a school in Southeast London. That's real work, isn't it? So I and she sometimes remind myself of that if ever I'm having too much of a moan.
Mam did it.
Yeah.
So tell me then, Ellie as a child, did she have funny bones? Like, what was there anything in... Because was your dad a comedian? Your dad's really funny, by the way, if anyone watches for Instagram.
He was a comedian. He was in the first wave of alternative comedians. So in the 80s, this sort of movement really, I suppose, started where comedians were like, well, you know, there were people like Jim Davidson and Bernard Manning telling all these awful racist, sexist mother-in-law jokes. And these people were like, well, no, actually, we're left-wing and we want to tell jokes about Thatcher and about the state of society and also just funny human life in a way that doesn't involve punching down on another group of people. So he was in that. So I grew up with that kind of in the house. But I didn't realise for a long time I sort of started to think I was funny quite young, but it felt very arrogant to say that out loud. Do you know what I mean? And it's only really in recent years as an adult that I've gone, no, it's all right to be funny. It's all right to say you're funny. And actually that's your superpower, because my mum's very funny as well. So I think growing up I just thought, well, everybody's funny, you know, there's nothing special about that, you know, what are you showing off about? Everyone's like that. And it's only as I've got older I've gone, oh, not everybody has this, in the same way that I don't have talents other people had. I just did a podcast now with this amazing woman, Mandy Hickson, who's a fighter pilot. I've always wanted to be a fighter pilot. I can't do it. I'm absolutely shit at maths, but you know, I've sort of realised that, oh, we just all have different things, and that's what makes the world an interesting place.
Yeah, and the irony is, it's growing up, we tend to focus on where we feel the most pain or fear. So if we feel like, God, I'm no good at making friends, that's the thing that's in the forefront of your mind, versus an empowering belief of like, well, actually, I'm quite funny. You wouldn't know that was an empowering belief. You would just think everyone else has that, because we focus on the thing that we're not good at, that sets us apart from other people. We don't, our limiting beliefs kind of thing. So with you growing up then, so there's a lot of laughter in the house, everyone's funny. Were you, like, if I'd have known you at school, would I have been thinking, oh, Ellie was hilarious?
I was very badly bullied at school, like almost all comedians in the world. And I used humour as a way to sort of overcome that and recover from that. And I think so, but yeah, there was definitely a bit of class clown thing going on there for sure.
So we laugh about the bullying, but tell me a little bit more about that, because that's pretty horrific, and that can stay with us sometimes. How have you managed to laugh about it and not let that stay with you?
I think, well, a lot of it was I have a very supportive home life, and luckily quite a privileged one in that I haven't had, I didn't have problems really going on at home. And I had very supportive family who helped me through all of that stuff. So at home...
So you were able to talk to them about it?
Yeah, so I had people I could talk to about it who would listen and be supportive, and home was sort of a safe space. Again, I know this has been said a lot, but I do wonder how I would fair these days, because I know kids come home and then they've got it on their phone still, haven't they, or their computer, all that stuff, whereas of course I'm very old, so when I got home I was home kind of thing. So I had that, and I had a good, thanks to my folks, I had a good sense of self and kind of that it would be all right, really.
So you just had a knowing that this is going to be all right. Like, I'll get through this.
It was very bad, and it was not physical bullying either. It was not, putting me in the bin or, ripping my tie off. I was at a girls' school, and, girls and indeed boys, but I think especially in that sort of situation, it is a lot about groups and cliques and excluding people and all of that stuff. And so that was all sort of going on, and that kind of emotional bullying, that mental stuff, was very hard to deal with. So there were times definitely where I thought, this is just awful, and I can't, people would say to me, it will get better. And I used to think, well, how do you know? But of course it did.
Mm-hmm. This is what always shocks me, right? So if you go through that as a child, and it's rejection, it's feeling less than, it's kind of being fearful, and then going into the comedy world, which is full of rejection and like fear, being fearful because you don't know when you stand up on that stage whether people are going to laugh, although I'm guessing you've got some formula now where you go, oh no, that'll be a good one, or that might fall flat. But at the start, you don't. So how did you deal with that?
Yeah, you're right. You don't. And I think I was helped by coming to comedy relatively late. So I started comedy after I had my first baby, and I did a comedy course. And the thing was, I really liked, I know a lot of new mums struggle, so I almost feel guilty saying this, but I really liked being a new mum. I actually found the toddler bit the really tricky bit, but the new mum bit, the new baby bit, I really liked. I had a really nice husband, and my parents were, again, really supportive, had a lot of help, and I was really happy. And I thought, well, I'm going to go and try this thing, and if it doesn't work out, it sort of doesn't matter, because I've got this solid base, right, okay. I've got this foundation, and I sort of know who I am. I didn't have that thing, again, I know a lot of people did it, I've lost my identity, or who am I as a mum. I was just like, I quite like this. So I thought, well, if I go and try this and it goes wrong, it just doesn't matter. Whereas I think if I had started in my 20s, when I was a more vulnerable person and hadn't really worked out who I was, I think I would have taken the hits worse. And of course there were hits. All comedians have had bad gigs, so yes, of course there were. But
so what made you go for it? So you said you were trying it out while you were on maternity leave. Did you have maternity leave being a journalist? I'm guessing you don't, do you?
Yeah, because I had a full-time, I worked full-time for a website, so I started, I did the course in March 2013, so he would have been about a year and a half old then, but I was working part-time, and I just did this course on Monday night in this pub in Soho, and I really loved that. And then after that I said, all right, well, I really love this, I want to do this. So I started going to open mic gigs 2-3-4 nights a week, because I
on your own at this point.
On my own, yeah, because I read this thing about, I think Eddie Izzard said that you have to do 100 gigs as a stand-up really to know whether you're any good. So I thought, well, I'll do, I said to Pete, I'm going to do 100 gigs and I'm going to do it in a year. And he was like, he wasn't over the moon. And to this day, I've been told I'm not allowed to ever do that again, which is fair. But I did do it. And it was on that, along the way, that I met Helen and we started Scummy Mummies. So, yeah.
So you leave school, you've got you have an interest in gaming at this point. I'm totally trying to fill in the gaps quickly. You fill in the gaps for me.
So I left school, I went to uni and I did an English degree because I didn't really know what else to do. And I ended up playing a lot of Tomb Raider because English degrees, to be honest, don't involve a lot of work. And then when I came out, I worked for a TV company for a year, and then I was unemployed. And I just saw this advert for a copywriter at PlayStation. And I just thought, okay, and I applied for it and I got that. So that was my first job in games. And then I went traveling for a year, and then I got a job on a magazine writing about games. And then I got a job on Eurogamer, which is where I was for nearly 10 years, which is this website. And I loved that because it was a full-time job and I got to go all around the world looking at games and having a laugh, really. And then, yeah, had my babies, started doing comedy. So, yeah.
So what was the push and pull to go from that, which seems quite secure, like there's a wage coming, there's no worry, you know, what hours you're doing, to then going, oh, actually, I'd quite like to do this thing where there's no, like, guarantees. Like,
yeah,
where does that come from?
Well, there was an overlap, and the overlap was, you know, I started the comedy course and the gigging while I was still at Eurogamer, and I was working 2 days a week. So as you say, I had like an income, but the shift from full-time to part-time, I'd found very difficult. I was doing a different kind of job. I was making video content and I wasn't very good at it. I didn't really like it. It wasn't very popular. So that was the job, sadly, although I still loved the people and the company, the job had ceased to be as sort of rewarding, and I didn't feel like I was doing a good job for them. Mm-hmm. And then whereas the comedy, it wasn't taking off, but I felt I was at least learning something. I was on some sort of at the very bottom of some sort of ladder. Mm-hmm. And you know, I really enjoyed doing the podcast with Helen, and so, and then I got pregnant again for a second time. And I just remember thinking, it was really hard to say, oh yeah, I'm going to chuck away that solid income and go and give this a go. But I couldn't face doing it all again, kind of thing, doing the maternity leave and then the work out what my job is and what. So, I went to meet my friend for lunch in London. And I still remember, and it was a beautiful blue day and blue sky day. And I just thought, I'm going to do it. I'm just going to quit that job and do this and then see how that works out, which again, I'm very aware is a privilege a lot of people do not have. And I'm very lucky that Pete was able to financially support us and that I was able to do that. But I'm very grateful that I was. Yeah.
And what was the goal for that? Was it right? Well, I want to do this, this, and this. Cause it sounds like when you said that bit, right, well, I said to Pete, I'm going to do 100 gigs in a year. Like, that sounds to me somebody who is like, when she puts her mind to something, that's it. Well, I have to, there's a process, I need to do it, so I'm going to do that because that's what I'm told. Eddie Izzard said 100 gigs, I'll give that a whirl. What was the big end goal? Was it just, do you know what, I'd quite like that work-life balance of doing gigs? Or was it is money a factor? Like, is that a driving force? Or was it to have certain accolades? Like, what was the big goal?
It was never money, because again, I'm very privileged and I haven't had to worry too much about, you know, I have done jobs that I've worked in supermarkets on checkouts and in bakeries and all that stuff. I've always been able to make money one way or the other. And I was raised in a house where we never had a lot of money. But with the rule was we had enough money to put a roof over our head and maybe have a holiday, you know, to somewhere like France in a tent. Do you know what I mean? That was the sort of standard of living that we aspired to. And my parents always made money. So my dad was an actor and a comedian. But when he didn't have jobs, he would do motorbike courier work, or he would do supply teaching. And my mum, she wrote children's books, but again, she also was a supply teacher and a teacher. So I grew up with this idea of, you know, you have to make money, you have to have a job. It doesn't really matter what it is, and it's okay to pursue what you really love as long as you've got a roof over your head, if you can facilitate that. So that was my sort of mentality, really. And that's how I feel about my own kids. I don't give a toss if they're doctors or lawyers or whatever. I'd like them to be, I think wanting your kids to be happy is perhaps an impossible goal, but I'd like them to not be worried about money, but equally not be unhappy in their jobs. So but maybe that's not aspirational enough, I don't know.
No, I think it is. Like, there's a difference between waking up every day and going, oh god, to waking up every day going, oh god, I get to do this today.
Yeah. But I think there's a lot to be said for waking up and going, okay, I can face this today. I can bear to do this today without being deeply unhappy and miserable, which I think is a situation for a lot of people. And I've certainly done many jobs like that, you know, where you're like, well, okay, this isn't exactly what I'd like to be doing with my life, but it's not unbearable either. And I've also done the unbearable jobs. And so I'm very happy if I'm in the middle. And luckily at the moment, I'm doing stuff I like.
Amazing. So the end goal was to do comedy stand-up. Was that the first stage?
It wasn't really the goal in terms of I've just sort of gone, oh, I like this, I'll do this.
I'll do it. How amazing. Like,
which is a lucky position to be able to be in. But When I was at uni, I was like, I'll do English literature because I like books and films and drama. And I don't know what's going to come out of it. I certainly didn't think, and then I'll be a games journalist. I've just pursued things that I'm interested in. So with the stand-up, there definitely were conversations like with the 100 gigs thing where Pete was like, well, what is the end goal of this? Because you can't, like most comedians, their day-to-day life is going around the country 4 or 5 nights a week, like driving to Manchester and then back, or, you know, being away for 5 days on tour, or going to Edinburgh for a whole month. He's like, you can't do that. We've got a toddler and you're saying you want another child. What's the end goal? And I was just like, I don't know, but I feel a compulsion to do this.
Wow.
And now, of course, I know that all that stage time I did get was building a sort of, you know, it was kind of my university again. You know, it was building a sort of armor and experience for when Helen and I became Scummy Mummies and started doing our tour. Because then when we went on stage together, I kind of had all that experience of being on my own. And for me, anyway, being on stage with another person is a lot easier than being on your own. So, yeah.
So what? So from being a child to now, we can see that the journey to it. What's been, if anything, the biggest struggle that you've had
from being a child to now?
Yeah, like a mental struggle. What have you struggled with the most that you think, God, that really comes up again and that triggers me, or it sabotages you? What's the thing that comes back?
I think, well, as a child, I was 6 when my little brother was born, and I remember finding that really difficult because I'd been the centre of attention for 6 years and my parents were told that they couldn't have any more kids. So it wasn't like I was geared up for one day you'll have a little brother or sister. So I found that a big shock, and I was, you know, I struggled with that growing up, I think. And then, and today, you know, my brother has various mental health and addiction problems, and you know, we have a very difficult relationship, and that's been the great sadness of my life, to be honest. That's been the hardest thing that I continue to deal with. It's very hard on my parents. That's very hard to watch. So that's my sort of dark, struggly bit, if you like. But to be honest, there are a lot of people have deal with that, plus a lot of other shit. So I've been quite lucky. That was a big struggle, and is, as I say, an ongoing struggle. But apart from that, I've had periods like everyone has where I've had no job or no money or both, or, you know, I've fallen out with a friend here and there, or I've, you know, wondered what I am doing with my life. But I think that's just life, isn't it? I think that's the human condition.
Yeah, but how do you cope with that rejection in the comedy world? Because there must be things that you have tried for and then you have been told, or yes, you individually, where you've been told, no, we want someone else.
Oh, both. And Helen and I, if it's a reaction for Scummy Mummies, we, Helen and I are different in lots of ways, but we're also very similar in lots of ways, and we have pretty much the same values. So whenever we've been rejected, we, first of all, again, it's good if you're in a double act, you've got another person there to go. The burden is halved, because you're like, well, this isn't just about me. It can't just be about me. It's also, it's half of it's them being shit, you know. So that's a relief.
You, Helen.
Yeah. But you're there. You've got someone who sympathised with you, who knows literally what you're going through. And that's really valuable to have that person to talk to. Mm-hmm. And also we have the same mentality in terms of, we'll go, right, well, that's that. That's okay. We'll get up. What can we do to, you know, how can we use this energy instead of sitting around bitching and moaning, which, don't get me wrong, we do a lot of bitching and moaning, but then we get to go and say it's unfair and blah, blah, blah. But then we sort of go, what's a new idea? What's a new angle? What's a new thing that we can do together? And over the years, that's been things like, we'll do a whole month at Edinburgh, or we will walk to Everest Base Camp, or we will, you know, start a new thing. Or, you know, when she got divorced, she was like, I'm going to write a book. Brilliant. You know, so that's we've been lucky with that, I think.
So what would you say then on the opposite of that? So, you know, going from the opposite of rejection to, like, what's been the biggest thing that you still look back on and go, wow, like, can't believe we got that, or we've done that. And obviously there was the Everest thing, which I want to come on to. But prior to that, what do you think was the thing where you're like, yes?
I'm very proud of us. I'm very proud that we are 2 women running our own business according to our own terms and values. And that was never an ambition of mine. I never, ever, as a child or even a younger person, was like, one day I'll run my own business. I just didn't, we only formed the business for sort of tax reasons. And then suddenly I was like, oh, well, I'm the director of a company. How did that happen? I didn't mean to do that, but great, you know. I'm really proud of what we've created. I'm proud every time we get an email or a message, which we do still get a lot of from women saying, you know, you make me feel normal, or, you know, you make me laugh because you're so awful. Or that's really gratifying. I'm really proud of that. And I'm just really proud of the friendship, and that it's still, if anything, stronger, that we've spent all this time together, done all this nutty stuff together, and we're still going, and we love each other very much. And I'm, you know, I am amazed, I'm not daily, but regularly, by the fact that we met, and that still, I do sometimes think, where, what on earth would I be doing now if we hadn't met that night at that gig? And I don't know. I'm sure something, and probably
should, that would have been a great question for me to ask, wouldn't it? Right, well, right, Ellie, what would you do if you hadn't met Helen?
What a great question, Jude. What a great question. I've never thought about that before. I don't know. And you have to go, well, I don't know. But I remember we did last year, we did a 100-mile walk with my dad and Helen's brother, John. And me and Helen were walking ahead a little bit through some field. And then Dad caught up with us at the start, and he looked all sort of misty-eyed. And I went, you're right. And he said, I was just saying to John, how did these two find each other? How did they find each other? And I was like, yeah, all right, shut up, get over the stile, the pub's shutting. But it is mad. She was literally born on the other side of the world. And I'm from London, and somehow, you know, because I don't know if you know the story, but why would you? But we met doing stand-up, and it was months after we became friends that we learned our sons were born 9 days apart with the same midwife. So the same midwife had delivered both of our children.
Oh,
and you just think, how did we, how did that, I don't know how, because I don't, I know it's, I respect your beliefs. I don't really believe in manifesting stuff like that in the universe, okay, and all like that. I'm quite a realist. I'm quite practical. Yeah. I'm not saying you're not. I'm just telling you.
No. I get it. There's two parts to it. My head goes, come on, right. What's the facts around it? I go to the facts first to be able to kind of compartmentalize it, because I almost want to prove it's true. So I'll look for the facts that disprove it. I've just found this amazing podcast my friend recommended called Uncanny, and it's okay, all about the spiritual world and people who've got these ghost stories. It's a BBC one, actually.
Oh, sounds,
I know,
good.
It's really good. And they have somebody who tells you the story, whether they've experienced a ghost story. I don't know why I got on this. And what they're really good at is having somebody who totally believes in it and says why there's an explanation for it, and somebody who disbelieves and what the explanation could be. It's fascinating. Ooh, anyway,
that's so good.
Yeah, it's really good. So you and Helen, sorry, so you met, and there's synchronicities. You've got the same midwife, and you just get on.
Yeah, we just, I mean, I wrote about this in her book, Get Divorced, Be Happy, which is out now, listener. she gives me 50p every time I say that.
Fantastic.
But I, and it was love at first sight, which is a funny thing, because I never experienced that with my husband. We were the first time I saw him, we were at university, I thought he was probably a drug dealer, which he's not, I should say. But we were friends for years and years before we got together and then eventually got married. So I didn't have, with the love of my life in terms of my partner, I didn't have that lightning bolt thing at all. But whereas with Helen, she walked out on stage and was so funny. I just loved her. I just thought she was brilliant. And I just thought, I want to be your friend. Everything she said was hilarious. And then I met her after the gig. I went up to talk to her, and she was so funny, and turned out she lived like 5 minute drive from me, which again, and just another weird thing that of all the places, wow, she could have moved to in England, in London, yeah, she moved 5 minutes from where I grew up. So maybe I need to get into this manifesting thing anyway.
Yeah, yeah,
so.
Yeah. There's, I mean, you know, the facts are pointing to the fact that you manifested somebody who'd be on this journey with you.
So yeah, I just thought she was absolutely amazing. Obviously now I've got to know her better, so the shine's worn off a bit, you know. Really, it's more of a business partnership than anything else, Jude, but we're in it now. Fuck it, it's very lucrative.
It's making a bit of money, so we'll stick
at
it.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, yeah. We barely speak outside of the show. It's like Morecambe and Wise, you have separate dressing rooms.
No, although to be fair, I did hear her in the background before we started the podcast, and I was saying, that's exactly what I want. As I jump on a podcast with Ellie, I want Helen to have been in the house, like yeah. He's lived together like Ant and Dec. Live next door to each other.
Yeah, it's funny actually. We do always, like, even just the other day, we did a gig in Colchester, and they were like, "There's a dressing room, one for you here and one for you there." And we were like, "No, we Chessies. Have the same room. We have the same room. We like to be in the same space." But then we have separate hotel rooms now. When we started, we couldn't afford it, so we used to like sleep in the same double bed in a terrible bed and breakfast. But now we like to have our own space, even if it's in a Premier Inn.
Nice. So with the podcast, right, and one of the things I absolutely love, and it's funny because I was telling my friend about this yesterday, because we like to gossip, we like to talk about the stories and go, that person's amazing, that person, have you heard about that? So I was telling him about the Dalai Lama, right, and he hadn't heard, right, Google it, people, I'm not going to go into it. And I'd heard Johan Hori, who I love, like I think he is fantastic, the way he researches these topics and everything. And he came on your podcast, and what I loved more than anything is I saw a different side to him, where everyone else interviews him and it's serious and it's like, you know, yes, okay, you're going around the subject, it's fine. But when you guys interviewed him, I was like laughing along with you. Like, that's why I love your podcast, because you get people on, and although they're promoting something and it can be a really serious topic, it's fantastic how you can get into stuff. And that Dalai Lama, the story that he told before that story came out, like, I was like, well, I'm not shocked. I heard what Johan Hori said on your podcast about him. Where was I going with that? Yes. So with the podcast, what was your intention with the podcast when you first started it? Because I know mine's completely changed since, I mean,
has it? Yeah,
mine's teeny tiny percentage compared to yours. But it's definitely changed in terms of why I started it to where it is now.
Yeah.
And how's yours changed over the year, and what was the intention for the podcast?
Well, the intention, I think, so if you listen to the first two or three episodes we did, I mean, I'm not ashamed of them, because
I'm gonna go back over now then.
That's god. I feel like I shouldn't be ashamed of them, because they are what they are, and that's where we were, yeah. And we were working it out.
It's
and
a journey.
I'm glad we did them, and I've never thought about deleting them or erasing them, because that's part of our history, that's part of our truth, yeah. Right? So, but it's quite hard for me to listen to them because you can hear that we didn't know what it was or what we were doing. We were like, I think we sort of thought we were on Woman's Hour. But then, you know, was it the news? Was it like we had a section called Current Affairs, which is obviously ludicrous now. But you have to remember as well, podcast was quite a new medium then as well. Yeah. It wasn't like
so.
It
how
is
long
now.
Has it been going for you guys?
10 years, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
So when we started, there weren't really any other parenting podcasts that
Fantastic.
Weren't American and weren't just kind of about what car seat to buy or how to burp your baby. There weren't people just sitting around moaning and laughing about parenting. And now there's loads of excellent ones, not just ours, obviously. But so it was quite so generally the world wasn't really sure what podcasting was, let alone us. So we just sort of, the first ones were a bit serious and a bit stilted and a bit scripted. And Helen and I also at that time, we'd only known each other, I think, 4 months or something. So our friendship was still in its infancy, and it's still that sort of nicey bit where you're just, I like that.
And were you still kind of new parents at the time as well then? Well, you must have been, yes, because it was 10 years ago, you were new parents.
Yeah, so Charlie was my son. I hadn't even had the second one, and the first one would again have been about nearly two, just over two. Wow. Yeah, and Helen had two kids, but yeah, so we were still in the what I call the trenches, as a lot of people were,
ship it.
And then as it sort of over the years, I think it's evolved into, I think it's grown with our friendship, and I think you can hear that. And I like to think, maybe this is wishful thinking, that as a listener you can track the friendship and how it does transition from sort of being just super nice to each other to sort of what is now, which is we're not afraid to take the piss out of each other and openly mock each other, which is what real friendships are, right? Because it is a real friendship. So now, to be honest with you, I don't overthink it. Like, we do have a little running order with rough questions, but basically I just ask the guests kind of what I want to know. So we just recorded, as I say, this episode with Mandy, this fighter pilot. And I love Top Gun and I love all that and always wanted to be a pilot. So I was just asking her about that and, you know, how you get your call sign and how you wee when you're in the air. Just stupid shit I want to know. But then she started talking about Iraq and I wanted to know what she thinks as someone who fought in Iraq, what she thinks now that we know the weapons of mass destruction didn't exist, how she feels about that. So I just sort of ask what I like and hope that other people find it interesting. That's I think that's all you can do. Because when I was a journalist, even in games, I used to ask questions that were trying to get a gossipy headline out of someone, get them to say something controversial or get to the meat of it or get a secret, get an exclusive out of someone. And I don't think that's what our podcast is. Hopefully it's an interesting chat. And if we inform or educate, that's accidental. We are just trying to entertain primarily.
So did you, this is going to be a shit question. Could you have imagined, was it a statement? Could you have imagined how big it has become when you first started out?
Absolutely not. Absolutely. I had
And the guests no, that you've had on as well. Yeah, like,
we've had
amazing.
Some amazing guests. Amazing, lovely guests, and they've been brilliant. Some of our favourite episodes, though, are the ones where we just have our mates on, to be honest. And the feedback we get from listeners is some of their favourite episodes are when it's just me and Helen talking, which we do occasionally, either because we've you know, it's a special occasion or we've got a big life tragedy or achievement, or sometimes because we haven't really got it together to book a guest or they've cancelled.
A filler.
But no, when we started, I absolutely had no idea that in 10 years time we would still be making the podcast, let alone doing a comedy. We weren't even a double act when we started the podcast, you know. It wasn't like this is a vehicle for the double act thing. The double act came months after we started it. So it's all, but again, that's been my whole life. I've just sort of made things or started things and just sort of gone, I don't know, I'll do this and then we'll see where it goes. And it's gone in some really lovely directions, so it's been awesome.
I love that because it feels like your growth is very organic. Like I'm prodding you with different areas, kind of going, right, come on, what's your limiting beliefs? What's your mindset? What was your goals? And it's like, actually, I just thought I'd kind of like to do it. And that's lovely.
What you've correctly identified, Jude, is that there is no plan. This is what we're doing.
But on the flip side of it, if there's no plan and you've got no limiting beliefs about it, it grows organically without you sabotaging it because you're like, oh, well, we could do that. So like, which leads me on, oh, this was perfect. This leads me on to you performing at Everest. Like, how does that come about? That's nuts.
Yeah. Well, yeah, why not is a phrase that we use a lot. And then over the years, we have also introduced the phrase, I'm not doing that again. Because we have done something so a bit like we've done that enough now, or we've tried that once, we didn't like it, we're not doing that again. But Everest was definitely a why not one, because we'd run a marathon in 2021 because our friend Bryony said, do you want to do the marathon? And we said, why not?
Oh, yes.
So we did that. And then that sort of buggered my knees basically, and I couldn't run anymore, but I can walk. And then we were like, well, I've always been fascinated by Everest. So I was like, I'd love to walk to Everest Base Camp. And Helen went, why not? And then she said, while we're there, we could break the world record, the Guinness World Record. And I went, why not? And then it sort of,
Jesus.
And then it all got out of control.
And it happened. And you
and we did it. Yeah, we did it. Yeah.
And you've got a Guinness World Record for it.
We have the Guinness World Record for the highest stand-up gimmick. Stand-up comedy gig on land, which was at 5,309 meters. So we did our gig in minus 15 degrees in the gold cat suits in front of a load of Sherpas, almost all of whom didn't speak English, all of whom were very bemused. It was a tough crowd.
So it's a comedy gig with no laughs.
There was a few laughs. They were very they were very warm, not literally, obviously everyone was fucking freezing, but they clapped the songs and they cheered the cat suits and we felt them with us. So yeah, it was a unique experience, but we're not doing it again.
What do you get for that? Do you get like a nice little disc, a nice little frame?
Well, you get a certificate in a frame. We're actually going to the Guinness offices in a week for us to receive our certificates. We're very excited. Because I have got another Guinness World Record. I've got another Guinness World Record for. I played, because once we started doing that, I was like, hang on, well, what else can we do? So I played, and it was all for Born Charity, this charity that I'm an ambassador of.
Oh, for the premature
babies.
Yeah.
So I did a 24-hour stream on Twitch of playing this power wash game. And raised a load of money and got a certificate for that. More importantly, never mind the premature babies and the money. The point is, Jude, I got a certificate in
two
the frame.
Now.
Two. Double world record.
That
holder.
Should be on your management website as well, shouldn't it, really? Yeah. God, they need to update that, don't they?
Yeah. And do we go for the triple? My friend Madge texted me today to say, do you know there's a Guinness World Record for eating 2 kilograms of Greek yogurt in 2 minutes? Do you think you can do it? I was like, I don't think I can, Madge. That sounds awful.
And it's not even that like fun. Like, what else could you eat that's a bit more fun that you could give it a whirl?
I reckon
you'll get the most boring thing ever.
I really like smoked salmon. I was thinking I can eat whole packets of that like they're crisps, but 2 kilos might put you off for life.
You probably will. Probably will. Right. Okay. So, what's coming up for Scummy Mummies? Are you touring right now? Is there
always
tickets available?
Always on tour. So if you go to scummymummies.com, you can see all our shows. But we're doing, I think, before the summer, we're doing like Tunbridge Wells and we're doing, Taunton and Wells we're doing. And then loads more, actually. And then in the autumn, we've booked, like, we're doing a whole Christmas tour. We're going to Brighton and Bath and all sorts of places. And we're even booking for 2024 now. So, nice. And the shows do sell out. Not all of them, but some of them do sell out.
You coming to Newcastle?
We've just been to Newcastle a couple of months ago. I think we might be going back Christmas next year, Christmas 24, actually, I think.
Oh, my God. Because
we're booking that. But Newcastle's
a brilliant. It's nuts that you have to book that far in advance, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the theatres have to book, to book proper people in. But it's great. But I love Newcastle because my mum is from Ashington. So, honestly, just listening to your voice for the last hour has been delightful, Jude. It's very comforting. I feel very soothed.
Oh, bless. I know, I'll never lose the accent, will I? Do you know what I always remember when Cheryl Cole started to get big on, like, X Factor or whatever she was on? My mum went, yeah, I would choose. You sound like Cheryl Cole. I was like, mum. You've known me longer than you've known Cheryl Cole. Does she not sound like me? why do I sound like her? I've not changed. Whoops, if she sounds like me. Anyway.
Oh, bless you. Well, my dad, of course, is a fake Geordie because my dad is from South East London, but his granddad's from South Shields, so he used to go up there all the time as a kid.
Oh, my God.
And then he was in a kids' TV show called Jossie's Giants that was set in Newcastle, where he played a Geordie football coach. So you see, so again, the accent is echoes of the past.
Is your dad good at doing accents?
He is pretty good, yeah.
Oh,
Helen is absolutely terrible. I don't know if you've ever heard her try and do accents. She's the worst person I've ever met accents. I really enjoy it.
Make her do it. Right, we're going to wrap up now, sadly. And I have thoroughly enjoyed having you on the podcast. And thank you so, so much for taking the time out to do it. Because I know you don't do many solo ones or even guest podcasts. So I absolutely appreciate it. And thank you so, so much. And everyone, go listen to this. Who was the best guest that you've had on?
Oh, I
top
can't.
Five.
That's like choosing a favourite child. I don't know. There's 257 episodes. I can't. But I did really just enjoy the one we just did that's not out yet of Mandy Hickson. That was really good. Always love having our mates Sam Pamphlon and Steph on and Miserable Steve. And just so many amazing people.
I'll suggest the Johan Hari for everyone.
Oh, that is
a
good one.
I love that. And the doctor that you had on recently who's got the parenting book out. No. She's got the anxiety stress.
Dr. Zoe Williams. We've got another one coming out with a woman called Marie Gentles, who's does parenting, deals with really difficult with kids who have challenging behaviours. That's what you say, isn't it? So she's really good. That's coming up. But
I didn't even get time to talk about your other podcast, which I know nothing about, and I'm so sorry. Right, quickly overview of that podcast.
the other podcast, it's me hosting, not with Helen, but with another co-host. And for series one, it was with a lady called Stephanie Chivers. And I worked with her about alcohol because I wanted to, I started drinking too much in lockdown. And but I didn't want to go sober. I just wanted to reduce. But it was about how to manage that. Anyway, so we did a podcast called Sort Your Shit Out. And season one was all about that. And I really love doing it. It's really, if moderation or sobriety is something you're interested in, I mean, I would say this because it's my podcast, but I would recommend it. Not for me. I just talk bullshit and go, I don't know, Stephanie, should I drink this wine? And then she goes, yes, you should. And explains very calmly and brilliantly how to do that. So, and yeah, we're just working on season two at the moment. So hopefully that'll be out in the autumn.
Right, thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to the Unbreakable Mindset podcast with me, your host, Jude Daunt. If you have enjoyed this episode, then please do share with others. And it would mean a huge deal to me if you would rate, review, follow and subscribe on your podcast app. This will allow the podcast to keep growing and going to new audiences. And if you want to know all the ways in which you can work with me directly, please visit judontcoaching.co.uk. The links will be in the show notes.